Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Dark Reading Radio. This episode of Dark Reading Radio, getting the most out of your IT security budget, is going to be hosted by Dark Reading editor Kelly Jackson Higgins. She'll be with you in just a moment with all of her guests. Before she does, though, I want to remind everyone that the audio portion of Dark Reading Radio is only a piece of what makes this special. We also have the live online text discussion going on at the same time, and we'd love to have your voice in that discussion. Now, to take part, all you have to do is type your comment or question into the box labeled your post, then be sure and click the big red post button at the bottom. Well, Kelly, I know that you've got some great guests, and I don't want to take up any more time, so I'm going to hand things off to you to begin the show.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Kurt, for getting us started, and welcome everyone today. We have a really interesting topic, I think, that's going to be resonate for a lot of listeners here. As you know, security budgets are sort of gradually increasing in many organizations. But that doesn't necessarily mean that IT security is getting the funding it really needs, nor that IT staffs are getting the talents and sufficient resources they need. So a couple examples, a recent, the 2015 Information Week Strategic Security Survey showed that nearly half of organizations that had 100 or more employees said their security budgets were going to increase in 2015. But at the same time, only 27% of them said they had sufficient IT security staff to support their purchases. And then the recent Poneman Institute 2015 Global Study on IT Security Spending and Investments found that 60% of organizations are either unsure or don't think their organization has the resources to even meet compliance requirements. So what does this all mean? We're gonna answer those questions today. I have two great senior security executives who face these issues from the trenches pretty much every day. And that's Patrick Heim, who's head of trust and security for Dropbox, and he was a former CISO at Kaiser Permanente, and Jonathan Troll, the vice president and CEO of Optive, who is also a former CISO for the state of Colorado. Welcome, Patrick and Jonathan.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you.
So one of the things that I wanted to look at was sort of how you sort of prioritize some of your spending, and I wanted to get your perspective on this. There was a survey Black Hat and Dark Reading did recently that found that that security spending was up, but also we were at the Dark Reading's hosted the Cybersecurity Summit at Interop earlier this month, and we asked how many people felt that they were sufficiently funded for the coming year, and only two of 130 people said yes. And not even one person felt they had enough staff. So the numbers are still showing that nobody's totally happy with what they're getting funding-wise. So I want to kind of start with Patrick first and see what you think about sort of what these statistics and trends sort of say about the state of security budgets and whether it syncs with things that you're seeing out there or what you've experienced in your position.
I think given the complexity of security and what we have to defend against, any reasonably competent security professional who knows that complexity is probably going to want to ask for more and is going to be very unhappy with what they have at any point in time. But I think we also need to take into account business realities, that there is only so much that the business can fund, and we do have to prioritize based on risk. So, you know, when I see some of these stats around folks that are satisfied or dissatisfied, I think there is much more complexity behind kind of what the right level of spending is or what the right answer is. I also haven't seen spending really correlate very closely or be causation to having better security outcomes. In some cases, you know, we're very lucky in the cloud security or in the cloud industry that we can attract some really amazing talent. So PhD quality individuals looking at solving new security problems. So the degree of output that I get from hiring somebody who's really at world class at the top of their game is dramatically different than the similar talent I would be able to attract to say into the healthcare industry to solve various security problems. The other thing I've seen, which kind of like aligns with the staffing, is how much legacy is there in this environment that an organization has to bear? Because I've seen a lot of security funding being diverted from solving, quite frankly, interesting problems and just put into kind of keeping the lights on security, such as patching and updates of legacy environments. So it's really complicated. I would say most security professionals asking for more money are probably doing the right thing, and the trend it continues to increase, which I think is positive. Some of it, I think, is driven by fear on the part of businesses. I recently met with a security leader of another company, and you know, the board was scared to death of security breaches, so they opened up the pockets and said, you know, here's X millions of dollars to go spend. And at the scale they were at, they frankly hired somebody just to spend it. So in a way, the analysis was they may have made things worse by buying products just so they can spend the money that was allocated, but the metric wasn't necessarily aligned with how are they getting value and outcome out of that. And again, I think that closely, more strongly correlates with the quality of the staff that people have versus how rapidly they spend money and what money they have access to.
Those are really interesting points, Patrick. I definitely want to drill down on that some more too. I wanted to let Jonathan give us a little, share his thoughts as well on the statistics that we're seeing and the sort of discontent with the resources, even if the money's going up a little bit. What are you seeing, Jonathan, in your space?
Yeah, definitely. I think aside from some true outliers, I mean, there are definitely those on the tails of the bell curve, right, that either have tremendous budgets and staff resources, and those that have zero or very limited budgets and staff. You know, I think the broad majority of folks, like the stats say, are uncomfortable with their security budgets, but I would say they're more uncomfortable with their staffing. Most of the people that I speak with are typically more concerned with the number of full-time staff that they have available and the talent of those staff. And I think anyone that's working in the industry today will tell you there is just fierce competition for top talent in the cybersecurity space. And I'm not talking about, you know, top talent executives. Yeah, that's there. But for those, you know, truly gifted, you know, security engineers, security architects who can take a budget and truly maximize the risk reduction from that amount of money, those folks are coming at a very high premium. And if they're not happy with where they're at, they have numerous opportunities to move on and take on other opportunities at different companies. So, you know, my experience has been that, you know, without the right people resources, you can have as much money as you want, and you're not going to achieve probably the goals that you want. And I think that's where, you know, I see a lot of the companies that obviously I work with and interact with and those that I've been part of are really struggling. And again, coming from the state of Colorado as a CISO, you know, I mean, that's a whole nother dynamic at the government level where staffing and paying market rates is very difficult to do at times, and you have to get very creative to attract and really bring in that top talent. Then I think the other thing that I would just echo real quickly is, you know, unfortunately, if you don't have a very strong security executive that can really articulate and tie budget to risk, you know, oftentimes boards, you know, it's throw money at it. You know, and if we throw enough money at this, we'll solve this problem, and that can be a very dangerous dynamic. I think for that security team and executive, if you haven't defined what that problem is and even what the solution is. So that's kind of what I'm seeing out there today.
It sounds like we're 100% agreement on that. And You have to add on to that. I think companies, given the constraint around availability of security staff, need to get creative around thinking about alternatives on how they work within that constraint and maximize that. And I'm a big believer in looking back and really trying to slim down what systems they have to manage in-house in their data centers, trying to reduce their footprint and getting in more modern platforms so they get more leverage. And that includes making sure that something like a transition to cloud services is part of the security strategy, because keeping it in-house, I think, creates an illusion of security, but in reality, maintaining those systems creates a massive burden from a budget perspective. And given that security, qualified security staff just don't scale, it creates a long-term deficit for companies to manage.
You both raised this issue of sort of the talent pool resources. Basically, it's not equal for all organizations. For example, government organizations and healthcare organizations probably have the biggest struggle of getting the talent that they need, and that's really interesting. I don't know how you overcome that, but it sounds like what you were saying, Jonathan, was there's just some creative ways of using your budget, but I can see how that would still be a trade-off sometimes. But one of the things I wanted to ask you guys about, you know, we've always heard sort of, you know, security is X percent of the IT budget, and for a long time it was like 8 to 10%. Is there sort of an ideal percentage of the budget that security should be, or is it really dependent on the organization? Is there sort of a holy grail of what percentage it should be? Patrick, do you want to start on that?
I frankly, it's a fun question. It always comes up, and I think it's kind of the wrong question to ask without putting it into the context of the industry that you're in. There's going to be wide ranges depending on the industry. Even asking the question, is percentage of IT the right way of looking at it? I don't think so. And in many cases, you see security spend that's pretty significant that is not part of the security organization, and how do you factor that in? So I haven't seen this be a valuable question. I've seen it manipulated, meaning that when people make pitches to the board and to others, they can show comparatively within their industry how they rank versus others. But even that, given how security organizations are structured, sometimes within IT, sometimes in operations, sometimes it's part in engineering, part here and there, even doing the comprehensive assessment of how much is currently spent in many large organizations is quite difficult. So I find it mostly meaningless, to be quite honest.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was wondering if it would just sort of depended on the organization. What are your thoughts on that, Jonathan, in terms of the percentage of the budget?
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I mean, I think it's one variable when you're looking at you know your budget and whether it's sufficient or not. But I think in most cases I've seen it probably abused more than I've seen it used appropriately. And, you know, whether that's, you know, building a kingdom or fiefdom within your organization because that seems like the right thing to do. And again, you know, information security is such an organizational dynamic, and usually the FTE and the budget are dispersed throughout the organization. And every organization is very unique. But, I mean, there are functions in IR that really support a security program, whether it's new employee onboarding, policy setting. And if you're not comparing apples to apples, you can really use that data to misrepresent what you're trying to achieve. So I would say it's constantly discussed out there. I mean, every conversation I have with other CISOs and executives, that typically comes up. But I think there are much better ways to establish your budget and determine whether it's sufficient or not.
So sometimes that data isn't as meaningful as we like to think it is on the percentage of the budget. as we know, compliance has sort of traditionally been, you know, how organizations justify getting budget or even getting attention sometimes for security issues. But, you know, as the security industry knows, compliance doesn't necessarily equal security. Is there a way to use your compliance budget or allocations to sort of squeeze in more security purchases or investments? Is there any way to sort of use that to your advantage? Patrick, you want to go first on that one?
It honestly feels like the wrong strategy. If you have to use a compliance driver to get security funding, then that's probably an indicator that you have a deeper problem you need to focus on, which is that the organization isn't very mature in the way they think about or understand security risks. So I think I'd like to keep the compliance discussions separate from the security and risk discussions because they are two different domains. And again, if you have to rely on a compliance discussion to drive that improvement, I see that as an indicator of a broader challenge in that organization.
That's a really good point. What do you think, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, definitely my advice and the way I've always approached developing my own security programs is to focus on security first and foremost, and that compliance will come along with that. I will say that I have used compliance in different organizations to help me drive my security budget for what I think is the right thing to do overall as a security program. And again, that's sometimes where I'm partnering with internal audits. I'm partnering, I know it sounds weird, but even with our external auditors. I'm partnering with our audit committee of our board. Everyone has different drivers for their function in the organization. And sometimes compliance just speaks more fully to what the function of that governance or oversight group is. I guess it's not the driver, but I definitely want to use it to partner and to help me develop a more comprehensive security program. But I will flat out tell you, you know, just because you're compliant obviously doesn't mean you're not going to get breached or that you even have a sufficient security program. So that's kind of how I've used it and recommend that people use kind of the compliance side of the house. But definitely, you know, if all you did was focus on whether it's FedRAMP certification or HIPAA certification, you could easily, in my personal opinion, misspend a lot of your money chasing that down the rabbit hole.
Totally. And I would add that in a low security maturity organization, I think compliance can help establish that minimum keep the lights on type of a bar so that we're not getting into risk discussions. We're getting into really the basics and putting in place some foundational investments. But then we still have to have that risk-oriented discussion about how to advance beyond that.
So sort of in the theme of organizations who, you know, have a pretty tight budget, and they're looking at different ways to spend their funds. I'm wondering how can you use sort of open source stuff, for example, rather than maybe, I know one of the goals now is to not have to buy so much security equipment, obviously, because it's just there's just so much out there and you can be buying things that are obsolete. I know, obviously, we'll talk about cloud in a minute, but I'm wondering in terms of, open source tools, are there things you can do to save money there that you would recommend? Patrick, you want to start with that one? Are there like specific security tools that are already out there open source-wise you could take advantage of?
It's interesting. This, in my experience, is a function of back to the people you have in your organization. If you have individuals that are developers that can actually maintain open source tool, you have a DevOps culture that can integrate and run these things where there's an accountability model. If the culture allows people to experiment and adjust things over time, I think there are a lot of factors that go into the successful deployment of open source in companies. Then there are other cultures where you need to have very rigid production controls. You have you try to drive vendor accountability versus accountability to individuals within the organization. You have concerns about the technical skill sets for maintaining and like troubleshooting code and integration and whatnot. And those organizations, I wouldn't recommend the open source approach. You just basically are constrained by the people and maybe by the operating environment to have to buy products and integrate them. So again, this is not a simple answer. It really goes back to what are the organizational and the people constraints that you're operating in. But open source is fabulous. I mean, there are lots of amazing open source products that eventually also become commercialized and become supported. Completely viable, but organizational constraints on whether you actually want to implement it yourself.
What do you think, Jonathan? Is this something that you look at or that you'd recommend for some organizations to do?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, when you're – and I've been in this spot where my budget was unfortunately where I could almost count the money that I had available to my security program. If you gave me a stack of ones, it would take me, 10 minutes to count them up. So, you know, when you're in those scenarios, I guess first you ask yourself, why did I put myself in this place? But when you accept that and you say, I want to actually make a difference, open source Is potentially an option. We definitely did use, you know, numerous open source tools from, you know, vulnerability scanning, just monitoring changes to our perimeter. But I will say it can be very difficult to make those tools sustainable for an organization. Just because, I mean, you have to have the right talent. You know, if an open source project dies, is not updated, you know, can your staff take that on, or do you just accept kind of those issues? So I think they can definitely play a role for many organizations, but from a sustainability standpoint, it can be very difficult. But I've definitely used them to good effect in several companies I've worked for.
Yeah, I can see how the sustainability thing would be an issue, especially if you need the expertise built to run them anyway. Are there any, like, tools just off the top of your head that are pretty much would be, like, you definitely would have them on hand if you could, like, open source stuff that you would say, okay, everybody should probably have this or that?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many cool tools out there. And I'm actually going to defer on that one in terms of providing a laundry list.
Yeah, I mean the ones that I mean, I guess I've used that are just kind of standard would be, like, you know, Nmap for network mapping, even not necessarily commercial tools, but even some commercial tools that provide some limited community additions. So definitely for, you know, pen testing teams and vulnerability teams, there are a lot of products out there. For, like, malware analysis, there are a ton of free resources, whether it's like Volatility and some of these others. And then trying to glue them together is again, you know, probably more of the difficult challenge. But definitely use those. And again, for my threat and vulnerability management teams, you know, Backtrack and some of those open kind of OSs that are built specifically for groups like that have been tremendous. Again, it's just very difficult to scale any of those, you know, across a 100,000 endpoint, you know, type environment. But I mean, those are some that just come right off the top of my head that I've used in the past.
How about, you know, we know that a lot of companies go to cloud for you know, cost savings, for resource savings. Where would you say outsourcing makes the most sense in terms of saving budget in the security space, and maybe where is it not a good idea in terms of budget? Patrick, I know this is an area near and dear to your heart.
I think about it more than just budget. It's really around sustainability and economics. And I think we really don't understand what it takes to maintain a secure system in-house for the duration of its life. And what I mean with that is, like, I'll ask people to reflect not just on their security budget, but on their IT budget. And as they acquire a new piece of technology, where is the cost for monitoring and patching baked in, for doing the updates, for really making it, maintaining the security? There's an ongoing investment to any product that you're going to put on a network to keep it secure. And I think that the budgeting process, the economics have failed. I think most CIOs are under pressure to reduce their operating expense year on year, and most of their incentives are aligned around delivering value and new innovation to the company, which is not aligned with that maintenance function for keeping things secure in-house. So I think that when we look at alternatives such as cloud computing, they break that cycle, I think, in a pretty awesome way. They convert this unbudgeted, unexpected security expense, at least a portion of it. You have to look at what are the accountabilities of the provider and your own accountabilities. But it all of a sudden gets broken, and you have a very predictable cost that's associated with that, with a good chunk of security baked in, which also allows you to address some of the skill set constraints. You know, so when you move to a cloud provider, I'm going to be generic here, there are a number of things that provider does with massive economies of scales, with really great people on the back end, that you don't have to do anymore, that they take accountability for. So, and it's baked into that ongoing run rate. So I view cloud strategically as really being a way of breaking through that scalability limit that we have with, there just aren't enough security people out there. And the same thing goes for security-related services and newer advances in technology. So this is one of the few areas where I see a really positive trend. And security people, security professionals, I think, are recognizing this. And here at Dropbox, even, I get approached more and more by security leaders basically leading the discussion around adopting cloud versus being the ones that are in the blocker role because they see it as a route to sustainability for their programs.
Jonathan, you want to wait on that one?
Yeah, absolutely. I think much to the dismay of many staff that I've had over the years, I'm actually a huge supporter of cloud because of the benefits that it can bring to security. And again, I'm not talking about just any cloud provider. Obviously, they have to, you know, prove that they are going to take care of your data appropriately, and you have to feel comfortable with them. But you know, my focus has always been, you know, I don't want my team, you know, standing up, configuring servers, managing memory, worrying about database sizing, adding infrastructure. All of that just takes, in my opinion, away from the things that we really need to be doing, which are, you know, identifying which threats are most important, make sure we have the right technologies in place, tuning those technologies, responding and containing threats quickly, automating workflows where we can. So again, whether it's State of Colorado or any of the other organizations I've been with, and not just from a security standpoint, you know, I mean, I can tell you State of Colorado, we are one of the first states to move our email and documents to the cloud. And although it was met with fierce resistance, it actually provided us with tremendous insight and visibility instantly, you know, where we went from 18, you know, different Exchange servers suddenly to consolidated logging. You know, we were able to reduce the number of security admins just working on, you know, keeping the email filters up to date, you know, from 18 down to really 2, one primary, one backup. And I would say not even the same amount of security. We increased the level of security within that environment. So, again, I think you can have huge gains from it. And I think it's one where you partner not just with your security products, you know, specifically like endpoint protection, but, you know, you need to work with infrastructure and the different business and your marketing teams because there's a lot of advantages that the security team can get from moving products to the cloud, I believe, and really help with the staffing issue that we're all facing.
So this may play into some of the things we just talked about, but I know as a security publication, there's so many things going on all the time in terms of threats, technologies evolving, changing, and I wonder how we have a hard enough time sometimes prioritizing the news and what we should be covering, and I'm wondering from the security manager CISO side of things in terms of what you spend money on, how do you prioritize that given that you're getting so many things tossed at you once and you have to translate it into what's important to your organization? I'm guessing the word risk falls into there, but Patrick, would you mind starting with that? Just sort of how you prioritize what you spend first.
Steal my thunder with the R word. Yes. So we take risk management actually very seriously. We have a very structured risk management program. We go through and we really try to identify as a group and come to consensus what are the more significant risks that we want to tackle. And then we align the roadmap of investments around those risks very carefully. And, you know, that risk visibility in terms of what are we doing and the priorities and the kind of the line of what are we not doing is something that we communicate up and get sign off from our executive committee as well. So, you know, back to the budgetary side of things, a lot of it comes down to what risk is the business willing to accept. And the role of the security team, the security leader, is to help tell that story around, okay, this is what we can do with the resources we have. This is where we've cut it off and said, you know, what we're working on versus here are the risks that fall below the line that we're not actively working on. And you can adjust that scenario depending on the business risk tolerance. If they want to put more money on it, you can come back and show them, okay, we're going to take on this additional chunk, assuming that money is actually something that allows you to scale in what you're providing. So So it is very much of a risk discussion, and I would say the cautionary word is that the acceptance of the risk, I think, needs to be by the kind of the senior leadership of the organization, not arbitrarily kept within the security organization or technology organization.
Jonathan, how do you decide what gets prioritized and how?
Yeah. So I guess one of the philosophies that has actually changed for me with just more experience in this is that I've definitely shifted, and this is very broad strategic speaking, but I've shifted the amount I've spent on prevention to detection, response, containment. So where I used to have significantly more budget on the preventative side, I've definitely started to intentionally shift towards the visibility, detection, response, containment, especially quickly and at scale to achieve that. And numerous reasons for that. You know, preventative controls, if not done properly, tend to have a significant impact on the business. The business can only tolerate so much change in a given period of time, especially in a budget cycle. You know, if you're talking about a one-year budget cycle, we're more on the incident response, detection, containment. You know, there's typically not a lot of issue on the business where they're not being prevented from doing certain workflows and things. So that's been a fundamental shift, I would say, just overall. I also would say that I'm definitely prioritizing a lot more the user training component, the non-technical piece, just because I've found just such tremendous benefit in building a more robust security awareness, not just this once a year, you know, do this 30-minute thing, but actually working to make your employees part of my security team. I mean, I want every employee in the company that I'm the CISO at to be part of my security team and feel like that and compensate them for that. And so definitely that shift. And then I would say I'm a huge fan of threat modeling. I think oftentimes people have a very difficult time tying new budget requests and new projects to specific threats that they're facing. And specifically within that kind of, whether it's the kill chain or just kind of that threat model, where that investment is going to impact that threat and how much. And I think you really have to start with that before you start putting money in different items, because if not, you'll have a tendency to either overspend or spend in the wrong place. And I guess I would say that's for a moderately mature organization. Obviously, those that are just starting a new security program, that's a whole different kind of dynamic, I would say, in many cases sometimes.
Yeah, these all sound like really smart ways to handle, especially with this threat environment. I mean, so you're not blindly spending. It sounds like you're both much more pragmatic and are realistic about the threat and how you look at it and how you then decide how you're going to spend your budget. So that's really helpful. I can't believe we're at the bottom of the half hour already, so it's time to kind of move to the online chat. But I wanted to remind our listeners to join us for the online chat. You can ask Patrick and Jonathan some more questions. I have more questions for them as well. And I want to thank both Patrick Heim and Jonathan Troll for taking time to talk about this to us today. I thought it was really, really helpful, and it's great to get your perspective from folks who've been in the trenches doing this every day. So I want to have everyone join us over on the online chat, and thank you both for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.